Hey everybody, welcome to the Lex G podcast. Going to riff about the Oscar movies. Just going to go free form, maybe take the categories, but just talk about them in general. We're almost into March and the Oscars are about a little over a week away, so I'm really late to this, but I'm very well aware that I don't put this podcast out anywhere near as much as I'd like to. And as such, I probably, lose people who were enjoying it in earnest, and then it just goes away. And I wish I could do it more often. And every end of every podcast, I'm like, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to come back and tell you about Michael Mann and Paul Thomas Anderson and Walter Hill, and then none of it ever materializes. Then 4 months go by and I'm like, hey, I'm here to talk to you about Lisa Frankenstein. You're like, wait, what? And I wish I could put these out more often. It's a combination of things. But a weird thing is, I got really sick at the holidays over Christmas. And as such, I won't say what it was, but it was something I've been ducking for 4 years. Let's just put it that way. And I had to fly home and probably caught it on the airplane. And it wiped out my Christmas vacation, wiped out my holidays. They had me hiding in my childhood bedroom, hallucinating with a high fever. I was just hearing voices in my head and wanting to jump out the window like Alex DeLarge. And it was like, I was starving. And they were like, don't come out. And they had Christmas dinner. They're like, don't let him come out of the room. And I'm like quarantined in my, family home. And I was like, hey, mom, can you make me a plate? Can I get a plate? Can I get some turkey? And she rolled a dinner roll under the door for me. Like I was the Count of Monte Cristo. It came at me like that ball in the hallway in The Shining with Danny. And that was it. Like I had my big Christmas dinner. I had a dinner roll. And then a 2 week vacation turned into a 3 week stay in quarantine there as I just remained pretty sick and didn't want to fly back and, risk being around other people. And I just felt horrible. But two after effects of this are, obviously just, as a movie person, it's, you don't even have to have been sick. Like if you miss 2 weeks at Christmas, you miss they put out 18 movies, all the Oscar hopefuls. And there were some also-rans, and to get back to LA, in January 10th or whatever it was. And I had to hit the ground running, seeing everything that I had missed. And it was stuff like Ferrari and The Boys in the Boat and Aquaman and that stupid Sidney Sweeney movie. And then, Origin and Iron Claw, which I never even got around to do you hear that? That's the other reason I can't do too many. I don't know if you can hear this, if it's coming through on the mic, but in my apartment, they have like a family of refugees, and they're the nicest people. But of course, they've been in America for 2 weeks, and of course, already have a $60,000 BMW. And this chick who's I don't know if she's she has an Uber job or if she's what's her name? Maria Full of Grace or something. But she's doing constant trips out in the Benz, and it cranks up and she plays the loudest bass and the engine rumbles. And she's out there playing Darude Sandstrom under my bedroom window where I try to record this, and it foils my recording of this. And so in general, my apartment noise and what I was saying about December, those movies come out and came out by 24 of them. And I just couldn't get to them until a month later. So I'm still straggling on some of these. I just saw American Fiction last week. I still haven't seen Zone of Interest. How can you do an Oscar podcast if you haven't seen some of the movies? I hate when people are amateur like that. Of the three things I saw last year, clearly Oppenheimer was the best. And it's that, and it's my apartment. It's very hard to do this pod. If I can hear them, if I can hear their dog, wagging its tail through the plywood walls, they can certainly hear me hamming it up in here. And it makes me self-conscious, and I'm not in good voice. And, I'm making excuses, but it's very hard to plug in the mic and just go like I did before. And, so therefore you're getting the Oscar, pod 2.5 months late. And, but nonetheless, I felt like riffing about some of these movies and even some of the ones that aren't up for Oscars. I did really want to talk about Ferrari, which I liked very much. And yet, film Twitter is so baseline young now that we're at a point where when new, masterful directors put out a new movie, the prevailing voice of film Twitter or film criticism used to be some tweety old man, and you understood that he had seen everything and he'd been around since the 50s or 60s and knew everything and knew all the references. And now, at least on Twitter, it's very, and Letterboxd, which I don't go to Letterboxd, but it's very prized to be coming at things new from a new perspective, a young perspective, maybe a different, you know, not just the tweety old white guy who's 50 years old and a blowhard who's considered a gatekeeper now. So there's young people who, what I'm getting at is they're so young that they're like 22, 25 and got into movies like 3 weeks ago. And so like, they've never seen a Michael Mann movie in a theater before. So where I've seen like, you know, going back to like Manhunter and Last of the Mohicans and, you know, and I'm not saying like it's just like, I have a certain, obviously great love of Michael Mann, but so does everybody. But the young people are coming at it from a different time period. And like, to young people, like Miami Vice is sort of like they've sort of reclaimed that movie. You know, for us who were Gen X, and when that Miami Vice movie was coming out, it was like, oh my God, he's doing Miami Vice, because I grew up watching Miami Vice. And of course, Heat was like, you know, the movie of the 90s, that Heat and Pulp Fiction basically and Goodfellas were the three like towering movies of like my Gen X formative, you know, entering adult life world, where I was going to go I wanted to be a filmmaker and an actor and a con. And those were the movies that had just like hit that zeitgeist, hit that precise, you know, their time period for sure. But also just sticking with Michael Mann, like Heat was a, you know, it was kind of basically Thief plus Manhunter in a way, because you had the criminal, the Neil McCulley part, that a lot of that was from, you know, not from Thief, but it had a lot of, you know, overlap with the James Caan stuff and that classic Michael Mann, you know, existential, you know, anti-hero, cool, and that part in Thief with Tuesday Weld at the diner where he talks about his life, and it's like one of the best, that character development of that scene, and a lot of that stuff, a lot of the research, obviously, from not just, even something like Jericho Mile, which is that prison movie, you know, the racer in prison, TV movie did before Thief, like, obviously, a lot of that research he did about prisons and stuff, it comes out in little ways in Thief, definitely in Heat, and, you know, with Manhunter, with the Will Graham stuff, and you have this dogged investigator, and that thing that that man is so good at, that generally I hate in movies, which is plot points, just plot, 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 and he has this way of, yeah, the way that stuff unveils in Heat, but definitely in Manhunter, the details of the crime, the details of like Will Graham figuring it out. And then, you know, at the end of Manhunter, when he's, you know, it's probably the most dated thing, you know, it's like, I have no perspective on this stuff because I grew up watching it. So, and I was a teenager when Manhunter was cool and when Miami Vice was cool, and it was seemed so chic and new wave. And, even the keep, which nobody likes, and including Mann himself, it has that Tangerine Dream score, those shafts of white light, the glowing cross when those two Nazi guys try to steal it. And that booming Tangerine Dream kicks in, and Molassar and as the villain, and, Scott Glenn with the glowing eyes, the stretch of The Keep where Scott Glenn wakes up with the glowing blue eyes and his pillow feathers are floating around the room, and the Tangerine Dream kicks in, and he goes across that town in Romania, and he charters the boat. It does the classic man thing, the classic man where he holds the shot, where like a boat's going out to sea, or a car's driving off in the distance, or the boat, or the bus in Thief with the transponder on it goes off in the distance, and he holds the synth, man. You get the synth, and it stays on it, and then the synth fades, and he holds the shot. It's like the classic man thing, and those are like the elements of Michael Mann that I love and revere, and to me, like, I associate that high style and his ability to go back to what I was saying, like, that kind of style and existential cool, and people used to say zen cool or whatever about Thief and about Neil McCauley and Heat, and to take that stuff and then combine it with making actual procedural elements so exciting in Manhunter. And I was saying, like, at the end, when he's like, you've seen these tapes before, haven't you? And he does that monologue while that music, kind of the Graham's theme cranks up behind him, and Farina realizes he's figuring it out, and they got that big phony backdrop of the buildings at night. And being a teenager, that stuff and Miami Vice and Manhunter and Thief, it made being out at night exciting. It made the synth exciting and crime shit and you know, cool cars and glowering villains and stuff I've riffed about 100 times, but there was a whole aesthetic. And even when he did The Insider, obviously it's about journalism, which, you know, movie critics, that's like catnip for them. Anything with journalism, they're like, oh, because, you know, movie critics, you know, they're dorks in like jocks shoes who go to a rep house with like a Carlin ponytail and an Alt Weekly under their arm. If I can make it across town, I can catch Philadelphia Story at the Rex or whatever. But they all think they're, you know, Woodward and Bernstein, because they have a little bit of just enough journalism background or training. And they, you know, anytime you get a movie about dudes in like tweedy or like, you know, tan dockers in a powder blue shirt looking like Templeton from Wire season 5, they think that's them, you know. So it's like Spotlight and All the President's Men is obviously their big, you know, and that's such a great movie. But so many subsequent journalism movies fall into that of like, you know, waiting by the phone, waiting to go to press and the sources. We got to track down the source and hang out by the payphone. And movie critics love that shit. But The Insider takes that boring genre to me that I, you know, it doesn't do much for me. But The Insider would be that kind of movie. But it like takes the tropes of it, but he like gives it the high style, the man style. He has that kind of jagged opening scene where Pacino, he's got the bag on his head to go out, you know, so that he doesn't see where he's being taken out to the desert to meet that warlord or whatever. And it's shot in that man, the keep style. And even though, yes, we're watching a movie about this science teacher, those like character details, that part is so great where Russell Crowe is just teaching science and you just see like how much science means to him. His way of like unveiling character and plot in a way that like so many other directors just bore me with. And then he ladles on like the classic man sheen in that. And that part, you know, where he's staying in the, Crow's staying in the hotel and the walls or the, whatever the wallpaper is starts to kind of, it's kind of an impressionistic scene with like the wailing music. And maybe it's a little dated because it was definitely in that era where they would do the like the heavenly Lisa Gerrard chorus. And some parts are kind of ridiculous. Like there's that, the greatest thing in The Insider is like everyone in every airport, every McDonald's, every like barber shop across the land is like inching in to get a closer look at the TV as journalism is happening. Like when this, you know, Wigand story goes on 60 Minutes, like everyone's like giving these meaningful looks. They're like mugging. Like it's like the Andy Kaufman movie where everyone's like checking out, like, what's he gonna do now? It's like bad extra work. But in The Insider, it's when that 60 Minutes story goes to press and everyone, or goes to air and everyone's watching it. And it's maybe a little histrionic, you know, it's maybe just a little bit over the top, but I also like, he takes on a certain style. He was kind of built into the style anyway, but like the kind of these angles are a little bit amiss and like filming shots through like the corner of eyeglasses. It has this very paranoid component. I remember in Collateral too, that at the beginning when Jason Statham has that little cameo and the way he shoots that when he and Cruz cross paths, which is such a great moment. And it's even better now because Statham's a much bigger star now than he was the Transporter already then. So it was even funny then, the idea that like Michael Mann, someone once said of Michael Mann, I wish I could remember who said this, that, and it's such a great line, even though he's, you know, he's a genius and everything. They said like Michael Mann is the kind of filmmaker who seems like he doesn't watch anybody else's movies, which I 100% know what they mean, but certainly he does and probably knows old crime films and stuff. But you'd always get the sense about Michael Mann is he has his own world, his own elements, and if he weren't making movies, he'd be hanging out in some prison, you know, prison yard, like talking to Eddie Bunker or some shit. Like he wouldn't be, you can't see like Michael Mann going to like the New Beverly. He's like, I gotta go watch Come to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean tonight at the New Beverly. Like he just doesn't seem like he incorporates, anyway, it's like he's off in his own little world. There's a bunch of directors like that, like David Lynch. Sometimes it's some of the best directors. Like, you know, there's obviously your Scorsese and your Tarantino, and the late Joel Schumacher was like this, where he had to see everything, and he knew every movie in and out, and he was like a real film buff. I don't know why I'm singling him out more than obvious, because you know Tarantino, Scorsese, Spielberg, of course. But then there's guys like, you can't see like David Lynch going like, hey, I'm going to go to the Burbank 16 to see anyone but you. They like kind of live off in their own world, and like Michael Mann stays Michael Mann. He's beaten to his own, he's marching to his own drum, no matter what. But I would say, I'm carrying on the man little mini lightning round too much, but I would say Ali is sort of unsung as like a pivotal moment where like that style that I'm talking about, the old style MTV 80s new wave, you know, 90s crime epic, synth music and Swami music and plot points and Will Graham investigative stuff, that type of Michael Mann, who was so, I remember the great movie critic Kenneth Turan said, like, his movies just mainline intensity, even something like The Insider, it's so intense, you're so wound up watching it. And when he got to Ali, which is, I think, great, I think it's kind of unsung to some degree, although it's a little bit of a misfire in a lot of ways, and it covers, it's weird that it covers, it's funny, I just said, like, he seems like the kind of director who doesn't watch other people's movies and kind of doesn't know what else is out there. I wonder, like, there's so much crossover with Malcolm X in the Malcolm X stuff, which we all know, like, so we were all like, we've seen the Spike Lee movie, dude, but he's doing it over again. Like, he's kind of unaware that we've seen a movie about this, like, in the last 10 years. But Ali is kind of like where I'd pinpoint, obviously, the beginning of his sort of digital obsession that became his thing for about a decade or so there. There's just a few shots, but there are little shots in Ali where he's kind of experimenting with video and a different type of atmosphere, a different type of narrative approach. Instead of the usual Michael Mann, you know, 1, 2, 3 intensity, it has long scenes devoted to one, you know, little moments, and then the other things are just glossed over. It's kind of a misshapen movie, and not as an accident, it's sort of what he started to go for, with the obvious exception of Collateral, which is like a tight screenplay, and it's his little, you know, more of his old style, although digital, like the digital thing was the big appeal of Collateral. But with Ali, you start to get these like half overheard moments, and one of the things, like in Heat and in The Insider, is that deep bench cast where you're like, everybody in Heat gets their big moment, whether it's Wayne Grow or Rollins or Hank Azaria or whoever, Natalie Portman, obviously. And in The Insider, you know, everyone talks about that great moment with Brother D-Day, Brother Bluto, what's his name, Bruce McGill and Wings Hauser shouting at each other. It's so perfect. You know, everybody is cast in every little role. And I would say from Ali on, you'd get those big actors in these roles, and they kind of don't do a lot. Like Ron Silver just being on the periphery and that, or like when you get to Public Enemies, which is kind of my least favorite Mann movie in a lot of ways. You have a lot of like familiar faces, but it was like, you didn't earn your Michael Mann card. Why is Sean Hattasy in this? What is Giovanni Ribisi doing in here? And at the time, Channing Tatum was kind of a lightweight. It's like, how did he get in Public Enemies? But he started to take on this style in Ali that was a little like whispered, a little overheard. It was almost incidental. It was like, if you know old Abel Ferrara movies, there was a thing that Abel Ferrara could do in things like Dangerous Game and in King of New York, where he didn't lay it all out. Like, you'd have to like inch in and like, wait, who's that? And you would just pick up little fragments of dialogue. And the way Mann, his soundscape was always very distinctive. Even in Heat, there's that great part where they're outside the drive-in and he's like, the bank is worth the risk. And it was like a big trailer moment when whoever's, the bank is worth the risk. I think it's Kilmer's line. And the way it's recorded, just a little bit low, he started going bananas with that. A little bit with Ali, but Ali's a pretty voluble movie. But when he gets into Public Enemies and Miami Vice, the things that you would think would be big and bombastic and, you know, straightforward, he takes, like, you get to Miami Vice and he's like, he's done as much of the crime movie tropes and as much of the, you know, investigative stuff as you could do at that point, and he's interested in the Gong Li romance and the atmosphere, and those movies become very sensory driven. Like Miami Vice, that's why I was getting to, like, what the young people like about it is the vibe. That's this thing that young people say, oh, it's the vibe, Miami Vice is a vibe. And it's sort of been reclaimed by the, you know, millennials and maybe Gen Z, where they just like this atmosphere, this hangout atmosphere and the romance. And in Miami Vice, like, well, obviously there's the big action stuff with like the neo-Nazis and the shootouts and that at the end when what's his name gets splattered against that backdrop, it's very Michael Mann. That villain is so good. John Ortiz is great. And then Luis Tosar is like this emissary of evil in Miami Vice, and that shot of the back of his head. If I had more time, I would tell you my theory that like all the great Michael Mann secondary villain guys are all descendants of Molossar from the from the keep. Because the way Molossar, that big monster with the glowing eyes, and he has that skullet, and he's big and imposing and fills the frame, and he's like just sort of a force of evil, force of nature in the keep, if you've seen the keep. And then that's kind of how he shoots, well, Dolarhyde is the main villain in Manhunter, but the way Tom Noonan is lit and framed in that, he's like human version of Molossar. And then Waingrow is kind of that too. He loves that sort of like big, and then Luis Tosar with his big dumbass bald sides head, and that shot, that push in on his head when he's going to lose his, oh man. But Miami Vice is awesome. Obviously Collateral, high, you know, Collateral is like, you know, because you got Cruise, you had the script that was in large part by, you know, Stuart Beatty script, not a man original. So it's more of like, I remember when Cruise was promoting that movie, he was like, this script is so tight, you could tune a piano to it. That was his big line. He'd go on every talk show, like when he was doing the promotional cycle, he'd be like, you could tune a piano to it. He's always like, ooh, he's gonna, you could tune a piano. He was like talking about how intense it was. So Collateral had that old intensity, but he was doing it with that like digital, that God, the way the LA is shot in that movie, it adds so much to it. I know there's some people who are purists who, you know, everything's got to be on film on 35 millimeter and don't like his experimentations. I would buy your argument that maybe it doesn't work as well in Public Enemies, because Public Enemies being a period piece, it's very weird. Like that scene at the hotel where Stephen Graham's hiding out, and you're shooting it on this, at the time, what looked like a camcorder, like a DV camcorder. It was kind of jarring for a period movie. Like I said, that one's not really my favorite. But in Collateral, Miami Vice, and later Black Hat too, I would say Black Hat too, the way that digital and that look enhances what he's going for, and he's no longer going for that, you know, ABC procedural kind of, you know, deal that he's, you know, he had done by then. He's taking these, you know, big moments and making them small, and little moments and making them kind of what it's about. And especially when you get to Black Hat, and he's just there for like the ambiance and that atmosphere, and the movies are kind of like sweltering, and that photography like brings it out. They're, you know, the younger viewers, it seems like, and it's cool to me to watch it. And this is a rare case where I'm like all for this, because it's kind of, it just happened with Tony Scott too. Like there were a lot of old fuddy-duddies in my Generation X, and certainly the boomers before me, who Tony Scott was like, oh, he's like style over substance and flash and trash, and he's just, you know, cool images, but there's nothing. And like, I love Tony Scott. Tony Scott and Michael Mann were like my two guys, like in the late 80s, 90s, just like I was obsessed with that look. It was the epitome of everything that was exciting. So to see young people come around on Tony Scott, who's like exalted now, and then there's still dudes in Gen X who I'll talk to on Twitter, they're still like, they're still not seeing the magic in Tony. Like, has this not been, you know, settled by now? But I like seeing the younger people gravitate toward Michael Mann, but it's interesting, they're going at it from a totally different perspective and going about the vibe and those elements that are just, you know, sort of awesomely indulgent in terms of, you know, just staying on the atmosphere and staying on the look and like the way, God, like at the end of Miami Vice, that last scene between Colin Farrell and Gong Li, the way those palm trees are swaying, the sound mix, and it's so like lush and romantic, but it's got that digital and the way that sheen, and it's like, and that escalating, whatever that music is, it's, oh, the, like, it's just perfect. And like, when I saw that movie in 2006, I know I was mad it wasn't like the bank shootout from Heat crossed with, like, you know, Will Graham piecing it together. Like, I wanted Farrell and Fox, like, sitting around, like, an all-white, new age, new wave 1986 apartment with, like, white banisters, and, like, Jamie Foxx's eyes would just start glowing like the girl from Manhunter, and they'd be solving the crime, and, like, some Eric and the Reds music would be kicking up as they, like, plot, you know, piece together the plot points, and it's none of that. It's this, like, lush romance with Gong Li, and then when he does Public Enemies, which I, it's, again, it's not really one of my favorites, but the thing that works best in that is Marion Cotillard, which is sort of prologue for what I'm going to say about Ferrari. But even Michael Mann is sort of softened in his old age in sort of a way that, like, Oliver Stone, when he got to, like, the Wall Street sequel and Savages, most notably with that fake-out ending, where he has it both ways, where, like, it ends with all the carnage you'd expect from the, you know, U-turn natural-born killers guy. And then we get this, you know, light ending that, you know, he gives his characters a break at the end of that movie that I thought was sort of interesting. It's sort of like an old war horse, this old mean old bastard, You know, and he does it to Gecko too in Wall Street and in the second Wall Street. And that's why everyone hated that movie. And, you know, he sort of lets Josh Brolin become the villain, but, you know, Gecko gets these grace notes and he's this doddering old man and he kind of gets to be the good guy. This, and that's why the movie's not as well remembered. It's why it wasn't very successful. Not in the way that the old, you know, he did, there wasn't a second Oscar for Michael Douglas out of that, but it was like Oliver Stone kind of like emphasizing something different in his later movies, and they weren't as successful, and he wasn't the same guy. He, you know, he sort of channeled all that sort of anger and firebrand intensity into his documentaries, but, you know, for his movies, he went a little soft. And Michael Mann, he went more for like this romantic notion of, and using the digital photography and the way he shoots locations in Black Hat and stuff. And it's like, I to keep going back, this is completely sensory thing, not a plot driven thing. It's closer to like a Wong Kar Wai thing than it is to like the, you know, ABC procedural kind of thing you wanted out of, you know, vintage Michael Mann. And the young people have really claim that as their own, but to like an old grump going through it in its day, like Collateral was like exciting and everything, and that, like, that was, you know, yeah, all right, the photography was a little different, but man, that part where Cruz sees the coyote and the sound garden comes on and those trees, that sky looks so awesomely huge, and you see, oh god, when you can see like an airplane pass by up in that digital brown sky, it's so beautiful. That movie captures LA at night so wonderfully. It's like, oh, and that club scene, and it's just, Collateral's kind of perfect in a way. I don't really, people fuss over the ending, and it's a big coincidence. Big coincidences were in mid 2000 cinema. Like, obviously, I talked about Crash and Babel, where everything's related. Siriana had that hilarious poster. It was like, everything is connected, with this stentorian bullshit tone. And Collateral, the idea that Jada Pinkett is the attorney, she's the last hit, is so, you know, it's like ridiculous. It's so convoluted in a way that movies had to do that back then. And it would be, you know, like supernaturally unlikely that that could be the, you know, the case, but whatever. Collateral was sort of like maybe the last one for the Gen X guys. And then Miami Vice, we were in its moment. I'm just saying, in its moment, I was like, well, this is really cool. This isn't quite what I expected. Public Enemies seemed like he was going kind of soft. And then there's that show Set at the Track. Remember, he had a show about off-track betting with Nick Nolte, and they killed about 37 horses filming it, and they had to shut it down. It was half of a Milch. They didn't literally do that. I'm just exaggerating. But it was half David Milch and half Michael Mann, but it had a lot of the Mann signifiers, and even in the pilot, and I sort of cringed, they reused the opening music from Heat when Neil McCauley gets off the train and arrives, you know, at the subway station at the very beginning. They reused that, and it had that sound design. It had that really lowered sound design, to the point where I remember on Twitter, there were people saying, like, has Michael Mann lost his mind? Is he senile? Can he not hear? And, like, it felt like he had kind of lost the touch. And Black Hat, which I love, but I love it because it's, like, a greatest hits. It's like when De Palma did Passion. It's like, you know, a run-through of some of his favorite moments and some of his, you know, Chris Hemsworth literally looks into the camera and says Will Graham's line about, you know, you son of a bitch or whatever. And he's just having fun playing with his own tropes. It's like, you know, it was Passion, the De Palma movie with McAdams and Noomi Rapace, where he's goofing off. It's an old man just playing in his sandbox. And I liked it, but it did seem like he'd kind of maybe like, all right, you know, he's the old man. He hit that De Palma zone or that John Carpenter or John Landis zone where he was sort of fading out. And then right around that time, like the millennials and the Zoomers have discovered, or maybe about 5-6 years ago, whenever it was, they started to take on this great affinity for Miami Vice, and he built and built, and like, oh, you know, they would discover Black Hat and talk about Thief so much. Nobody ever goes back to Mohicans, I notice, and The Keep. That's my big thing, is to always stump for The Keep, because it's so crucial in the pantheon to me. So, like, fast forward to the last couple years. First, he does the Heat 2 novel, which, you know, reinvigorates everybody's great love of Heat and, you know, Michael Mann. There's this reverence that comes back. He did this awesome, I would recommend it, the CBS Morning News interview where he's doddering around Italy in a really baggy shirt, and he seemed really cool and with it. And I was like, Michael Mann hasn't lost the touch. Michael Mann's still awesome. And he was talking about Heat 2 when he was making Ferrari. And so, like, as I was started to say a half hour ago, when this podcast was supposed to be about something else entirely, The young generation, this is their first time they can say there's a big Michael Mann movie in theaters. And of course, they were going to be in the tank for this so bad. I saw a week or two ago, there's going to be an Elaine May movie, maybe, hopefully. She's working on it. And Elaine May's got to be 107, but whatever. If it actually comes to fruition and this comes out, I think it's going to have Dakota. Am I wrong about this? Maybe it's Dakota Johnson, somebody else who like Twitter carries on a lot about. There is no chance that would ever get like an honest review. No one is ever going to be like, oh, kind of, you know, this old lady's kind of lost it. It's going to be, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. This is of a piece with Heartbreak Kid and this and that. And that's kind of what happened with Ferrari when it came out at Christmas. It bombed. It was a tremendous, you know, bomb. I mean, you find out in these moments how small film Twitter really is. We had this last week with that, you know, the Ethan Coen driveway dolls, which I haven't seen yet. I have nothing against, but at least in certain quarters of film Twitter, you could be online and these guys are like, oh, is Ethan Coen the same without Joel Coen? This is so great. What about Margaret Qualley? Oh, this is the big moment. Maybe Driveway Dolls will save theatrical because it's screwball comedy and people want character movies back. And then it opened to like $35. This happens so often with film Twitter. I don't even know why. Like, there's not even a case to be made here. Like Licorice Pizza, too, which is great, which is Paul Thomas Anderson in general. It's always like, the new PTA movie. And then he's great. He's, you know, a hero to me in some ways. I don't know. I hate when people say shit like that. But, you know, he's a director who meant a lot, especially when I had just come to L.A. and Hard Eight and Boogie Nights and Magnolia, especially then. And then Plainview, my favorite character of all time. I love Paul Thomas Anderson. But every time he has a new movie out, there's this great to-do. Well, and it's already started with the next one with DiCaprio. And people are sharing these screenshots of, like, you know, on the street. Like, oh, the master's back. Oh, it's PTA. Oh, this is going to be one of the great. And then it always comes out and makes, like, no money. You know, like in L.A. They felt like when Licorice Pizza came out, it played like 4 months straight, every auditorium, every theater, especially like there was this grand movie palace in Westwood that got it first, the Village Theater. And it was like a weekly pilgrimage. Everyone on the Twitter, like going to see PTA. It was like they were clocking in to like perform their military service or their church service, or like making the pilgrimage, new PTA. And they would go and I would look, you know, it was sold out for weeks. And then it opens up in like the Heartland. Nobody cares. No, like, oh no, it's Philip Seymour Hoffman's son. We got to go see this. It's all this stuff is always the greatest shit ever to like a very rarefied type of movie, precocious movie person. And the regular guy just doesn't care. Anyway, Ferrari, to go back to what I was saying. So this comes out at Christmas and all of the tweets from all the usual suspects are effusive. This is classic man. This is vintage man. Someone I like very much said, this is key man text. And the funnier thing was everyone was trying to write their little blurb on Twitter in the parlance of Michael Mann. Like, they couldn't just say, oh, this movie's really good. Adam Driver's fine. Penelope Cruz steals it. Needed a little more style or something. No, it was always like, man becomes his destiny. Metal becomes man. This is like, they had this ridiculous, like, they were writing it like they were Neil McCauley talking about, like, metals or something. It was like, it's like, man embraces his future. Man becomes the destiny that is metal. Two cars collide at once. It's like, dude, just say if it's good or not. Everyone was being really ridiculous about it. And so I was like, I knew I would like it, and I did like it very much. I just, all the things that I've just said for the last 30 minutes, I got what I knew was going to happen with Ferrari, and it's new Michael Mann. It's the Michael Mann post-Ali, definitely post-Miami Vice style, where it's less about the excitement. You know, it's called Ferrari. Like, how about some dudes racing cars instead of watching Penelope Cruz go to the bank for 2.5 hours? It's like, hey, my check is stale dated. Can I get a withdrawal? Can I switch this? Here's my routing number. Can we change this from checking to savings? Like, there's a whole lot of her going to the bank and busting Ferrari's balls, and he's got a mistress played by Shailene Woodley, which you can do the math on whether you would cheat on Penelope Cruz with. Shailene Woodley is a hot dog. She looks like a hot dog. I've always said this. She's awesome. Like, she's a good actress. And when she showed up in that Alexander Payne movie, I thought, oh, she's going to be a superstar. And then she immediately became a hot dog and started doing the Dakota Pipeline thing and got really granola and dated Aaron Rodgers. And this is going off track, but like, It seemed like she was doing all these weird interviews. What was her thing? Like she was making clay with her vag or something. It was something completely off-putting, and then wasn't in stuff as much for a while she was with Rogers. And she seems to be this year's beneficiary of the old, my theory that like they must get a new agent or something, because she was also in Dumb Money at the same time as Ferrari. So it's like, I mean, she's had a nice little comeback. She's fine. Everyone's okay in this, except Penelope Cruz is terrific. And that's great, but it's also very much the thing we do now, or they do now, where the movie can't be about the real guy. It can't be about, you know, I thought this about the Bob Marley movie a week ago, which I liked fine, but I want to watch Bob Marley do his tunes, man. I want to see him do a big concert. I don't want to hear about Bob Marley's wife busting his balls about his affairs and his schedule and stuff, because it has Lashana Lynch, and she's the wife, and of course, she's the strong, powerful woman behind the man, and that's what we get every time now. That's kind of what Ferrari is, and that's fine to some degree. It's not out of line here, because it's of a piece with how prominent Cotillard was in Public Enemies, and it's kind of a man thing. It's like how great Gong Li was in Miami Vice, and it's cool, especially coming from like early on, like in Heat. You might say that like one of the criticisms of Heat is that Diane Venora is this huge buzzkill with this horrible dialogue, and we want to see Al out on the streets being electric, and the best shit ever is at the end of Heat when he can't get away from her fast enough and they're having their millionth boring conversation, like Natalie Portman has slit her wrists and he rushes her to the hospital. He's like, not you, babe, not you. And they're at there and they're having their final conversation about whether they can make their marriage work. Venora and Pacino, Portman's in the hospital. And they decide they can't make it work because he's always got to be out on the streets. And they're having this soulful conversation, this very Michael Mann dialogue and the angles and everything. And then he's like, he's got to get back out there. He's like, the leads come in on Wayne Grow or something, or whatever it is. And he runs down the stairs like fucking Michael Myers at the end of Halloween. He's doing this. He's wearing that big mid-90s Steve Harvey suit. And the way he's just flying down those steps, like this curved staircase at the hospital that's so beautifully shot. And it's Pacino, and his bouffant is like bouncing up and down like the Pringles guy. And he's just like, get me away from this buzzkill. And a lot of Michael Mann stuff. You know, it could go either way. Like I was saying, Jada Pinkett, very delightful in the early stretches of Collateral. But you know, the way she's worked into the plot is maybe not seamless. But you know, Kim Greist in Manhunter is sort of a non-entity as Will Graham's wife. The Joan Allen stuff fares better there. But, you know, strong role, Tuesday Weld, Madeline Stowe, maybe not Alberta Watson, but who knows what he was going for with The Keep. But the point is, you know, there are, you know, intense roles for women, strong roles for women, but I think in the new Michael Mann, in a way he's kind of hip with it, I guess, because I sound like an old jazz man or something, but like with Miami Vice, with, you know, Public Enemies, and now with this, the prominence of the female lead and her importance to the story. You know, she's not just window dressing or off to the side. You know, she's this force. And it's only annoying to me in that there's so many movies that do this now. Like the Napoleon movie, which just came out too in this past Oscar season. But that's another one where it's like, oh, gee, I'm here to hear who would possibly be at Napoleon to hear about Napoleon sacking a city or taking on the troops over the ice at the Battle of Austerlitz? Who would want any of that? Is it Austerlitz? Is that what it is? Whatever it is, Waterloo. And it's all well done, but like half the movie is, you know, Vanessa Kirby, and it's like, you know, the strong woman who kind of cucked him and kept him on a leash, and oh, she's having her affairs, but she's like a modern woman, and she's showing him her vag, and he's like, oh, he starts doing all his mugging faces. We have to have the narrative now that the woman's in command. It's very much a modern sense, a sensibility of the moment. I won't say modern, because these things are always cyclical, and you could say there were 70s movies that had this prominence too, but at the moment, when you do this kind of movie about the great man, it can't just be the man. You know, if we had The Doors now, we'd have to have the story of Pamela Corson keeping this, you know, indulgent douchebag on a leash. Like, that's the thing about the Bob Marley movie is, like, I'm there, it's called Bob Marley. I don't want to see, like, how many posters is the wife, you know, how many dorm room posters and t-shirts is the wife on? We don't care. Just play the hits, man. But in Ferrari, you know, it's very much the Michael Mann, you know, kind of template of a guy who's existential. He's a force of nature, and it's a man who, you know, he has all his things, you know, could be coming apart at the seams, but he's like, he has that Michael Mann efficiency, right down to that classic man way that Adam Driver's dressed. He's got his Count Chocula accent and his powdered white hair. He's got that donut sugar in his hair from the Hostess box where you'd get the three flavors. Remember the three flavors? You get the cinnamon, you get the plain, and then you get the powdered one with that white sugar. And if you ate it, and you get the white donuts too. And if you did that, like, that powder would give you heartburn for like a month. And, but he's, you know, he's made up sort of like, you know, Vincent in Collateral, like Neil in Heat, that man is a force of nature with all these external things and external pressures, but he's straight ahead. He's efficient. He's zen. He's got those sharp suits that are kind of a metallic color. He's taking meetings and, you know, talking to the guys. And, you know, in this movie, it's Enzo Ferrari. It's not a biopic nor a race movie. It's about this tumultuous time in his life where his company is sort of, you know, in danger. And he's trying to kind of leak it to the press that he might be interested in, you know, going against his better judgment or against his, you know, usual pride, and kind of looking for a deal to, you know, merge with some of his competitors. And he's lost a racer on the track and a guy who died, and he's going to work in a new racer, and they're training for the Mille Miglia or whatever the hell it is. And a lot of the movie, I can't spoil this, like, if you're starting to wince, like, because of course nobody has seen this thing. And you might want to watch it when it's on, or if it is on streaming now, I guess it is. You might want to watch it after hearing this. So I'm not going to take you plot point by plot point, but you couldn't. It's weird to say this about Michael Mann, because this historically, this would be the, you know, antithesis of Michael Mann to say that this is ambling, but it sort of is. It's more European, and it's a different, it definitely falls within what I'm saying about like the post Y2K, you know, this century's Michael Mann, where he has a different set of interests and he's let go some of that old style. And that's fine, but it's like some of that coiled intensity, that electricity. If that's what you're coming at this for, it's not really there. But I can't, you know, it's just a lot of the movie is just, you know, Adam Driver going about town doing he's like running errands. It starts out and, you know, Penelope Cruz is already on his back and shooting a gun at him about his mistress. And then he goes out to visit his late son. And a lot of this movie is about him and Penelope Cruz having lost a child and this new child in his relationship with Shailene Woodley and the parentage of that kid. And just telling you about that stuff, it makes it sound like, wait, was this the guy who did Thief? Like, where's the thief? But it's, you know, so it was weird to me. On one hand, the young people, you know, they're like, this is classic man, this is as good as it gets. He hasn't lost a beat. He hasn't lost the touch. And to me, I know in my heart, part of getting older is not just me and my expectations, but all your friends, your family, who once upon a time had your same frame of references or interests, including movies and music and stuff like that. They've sort of grown out of a lot of it, or they're kind of frozen in time. And I'm not saying that in a bad way, because I am very much frozen in a sort of late 80s, 90s permanent nostalgia. But if you think I'm bad at it, I try to keep up with the times. I try to roll with the punches. One of my idols at this was like Roger Ebert. And even as he was getting older, even as he had horrific, you know, that the health issues and stuff and what was wrong with his jaw and everything, he would still be so excited to see a new movie. And I don't have quite that. I'm like worn out. Going to the movie theater is exhausting to me and everything. But when the movie comes on, I try to meet it on its own terms. I try to stay with the times. But I do still want to be in the game. And I just... There's so many dudes around my age who just... Gen X, like, just died in, like, 1999. Or maybe at 9/11 at the latest. But I know in my heart, as good as I think Ferrari is, if I talk this up to anyone in my age range, they're just going to put it on, be grumpy about it, and go, that's no Heat. That's nothing like Heat. You know, to whatever extent this guy probably knows anything about Michael Mann, he probably remembers Heat and maybe The Insider or maybe Last of the Mohicans. And you get this movie that's very, it's like closer to like Costa Gavras Z or something, only in the sense that it's like, you know, in this old timey little town and walking around the cobblestone streets, and then you're soaking in the atmosphere, and you have this, you know, lone protagonist who things are closing in on him from all sides, and how he's going to navigate this and that and his business deals. And a lot of the stuff, as you know, I've been saying about modern Michael Mann, Some of the stuff that should be really important is kind of backgrounded to the point where I keep saying this, but it's like half overheard. It's like whispered. It's like, who's that guy? Who's that guy? And when you used to watch Heat, every character built, you knew everybody's purpose in that plot. You knew Wayne Grove was going to come back around, or Rollins and Van Zant and this and that. And you watch Ferrari, and first of all, because just by nature of it being set in Italy in a period movie and it being so immersive in terms of that environment, he doesn't have the big stars. There's one other, the three leads, the three movie stars as the leads, Shailene Woodley, I guess if you consider her a star. And then Patrick Dempsey shows up with like some steely white hair, kind of looking like the man template. And like when he shows up, you're like, oh, at least somebody else I know in this movie who has some charisma. Jack O'Connell is in there, but he doesn't do much. Sarah Gadon, who's always super boring to me, is in there. But there are characters who you're like, wait, who's this guy again? Like, he's having these, like, meaningful conversations. There's this one dude who he has these soulful conversations with, and he gets his wisdom from. And I'm like, is that his brother? Is that his dad? Is that guy just the mechanic? Is that the guy he built the business with? You go the whole movie, you don't even know who this guy is. The other actors, other than the five maybe I mentioned, you don't know who anybody is. And you used to go see, even like I said, Public Enemies. Yes, like, all right, Channing Tatum hasn't earned his Michael Mann pass, but like, you knew who everybody was, and that was part of the electricity of those movies, is everybody showing, even like Collateral, like Ruffalo showing up, or Peter Berg, or McGill shows up again in that one. And in this, it's a very finite cast, and things that are just, you're overhearing, you're like eavesdropping on moments. And definitely with a man movie, there's going to be some element of coiled intensity, but it is slow to take hold. For a lot of the first half hour, maybe even hour of the movie, you're just getting these scenes of that are just, you know, existential. It's almost like an art movie in a way that would not please somebody who's going for like the lockstep plotting of a crime epic. It almost, in a way, it reminded me of the Clint Eastwood movie 1517 to Paris, which is not a very typical movie of Clint Eastwood. And the Clint Eastwood has a very classical way he does things. And also within his little like Eastwood palette of, you know, his visual style, usually he has those deep reds and the charcoal blacks, and he had that whole era where he was desaturating his palette. And this, as a Michael Mann movie, it's very naturalistic looking. It's very little grainy or gray and natural, and you're like, where's Molassar? Where's the Keep? Where's the Shafts of White Light and the blues and the synth? There's no synth. It's that Daniel Pemberton, whatever his name is, who scores every other movie now. And it's fine. It's like a classic, you know, movie, you know, a traditional movie style score. But when I want Michael Mann, I want synth and this mood and atmosphere. And that's why, like, as much as I like this movie, I'm hesitant to I don't like to recommend anything anymore, because nobody ever has the same reactions as you. And as we get older, as I get older, and anyone in my peer group is 45, 50 years old, they're going to remember the Michael Mann that I've been talking about for an hour, and that kind of thing, and that kind of style. There's one scene in this movie I just genuinely didn't understand, and you can come and make fun of me now, but like, I was like, did I miss something here? There's an early scene in a church in this movie, and Enzo and his whole, you know, his team, they all go to Catholic Mass, they all go to church, and they're going to church at the same time that there's this test thing at Maserati. Maserati is one of his obviously his big competitors, and they're doing this thing across town, and the whole Enzo team, the Ferrari team, is going to, they're going to catch a little Daily Mass or Sunday Mass or something. They're all in, like, I love movies with church scenes, because you can tell, like, no directors have ever been in a church ever, or not since they were 8 years old, because everyone's sitting there, and, like, no one's, like, yawning and sleeping and ripping farts and shit. Like, they're checking their watch, trying to duck out the side door after they get the wafer. But it's, like, every movie ever, like, the things that movie directors are oddly bad at. Any scene in a church is always a disaster. And a scene in a movie theater. Because the weirdest thing to me is, like, movie directors, if anybody, you would think they would be so reverent of theaters, of movies, of, you know, these, even like the Fabelmans. And their characters are always terrible, inconsiderate moviegoers. Whether it's like Scorsese in Mean Streets, where the crew is like heckling the vampire movie, or in The Fablemans with little Sammy Fablemans like hopping over the seats and talking about his life with all his buddies at full volume while they're supposed to be watching a movie. Every scene in a movie theater, in at Belfast, where they're, you know, throwing their hands up like they're on a roller coaster, like a crew of idiots when they're watching Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It's like, shut up. Uncle Joe Shannon, this was my favorite Siskel. Everybody's on the Siskel and Ebert kick the last few years, and I found their review of Uncle Joe Shannon, the Sacker and Burt Young movie, where he's a trumpet player and he's going to help the kid from On Golden Pond get an operation. That's something you didn't expect to come up in a Michael Mann podcast, but it's called Uncle Joe Shannon. It's a horrible movie. I had never seen it, and I was always fascinated about it because, you know, obviously in the wake of Rocky, I guess everybody was a little touched by the magic of Rocky winning Best Picture. So Burt Young himself got to make his own movie, written, directed by Burt Young, looking like he just showed up from the track. And he's a down on his luck trumpet player. He's so annoying in the movie. Anyway, there's a part where they go to a movie theater. He takes the kid to the movies, like to the Late Show, and he whips out his trumpet and starts playing the trumpet along with the movie. And I found the old Siskel and Ebert review of this, and Siskel's like, he's like cracking up, rolling about it. He's like, can you imagine that? You already got enough people talking in the theater. Some dude whips out his trumpet, and I thought the exact same thing. Like, shoot the trumpet player, man. But movie theater scenes in movies are always, and of course, spy movies where people come in and whisper and pass codes and shit. And I'm always like feeling bad for the person sitting in front of them who's trying to watch Casablanca or whatever. And they never seem to notice like Max von Sydow or whoever the fuck is behind him having a full, and Jack Ryan's having a full conversational volume, you know, passing state secrets, and some, you know, suckers there with their tub of popcorn and Twizzlers, and they never turn around and give them the big shut the fuck up. They just sit there and take it. And you would think movie directors would get that right for once. Anyway, church scenes, what was I on about? Oh, Ferrari. They're all at church, and Maserati's doing a test run across town at their track, and like everyone in the church is like distracted from mass, from Catholic mass, because they want to hear the results. And like all at once, they get the response to this, whatever goes on the track. Maserati's trying to beat this time of a minute 30 or something, and they all know, and like they commiserate after church about, oh, the results. And I'm like, did some dude have a transistor for the master of cinema? I'm sitting here for 2 months, like, did everyone have a transistor radio? They didn't have a cell phone back then. Like, how did everybody like magically know in a church, in an Italian Catholic mass, what this, you know, the track results were at Maserati across town? I was like whipping out my charts and graphs. I'm sure someone will tell me, like, oh, clearly the priest was giving him signals in the thing. I have no idea what happened in that scene, but it's all really good. And all I'm doing here is bitching. And when I really, it's probably one of my two or three favorite movies of last year, a year I didn't think was that great. And when I started this podcast, it was going to be about the Oscar movies, and I was going to bitch about Poor Things and Maestro and all that shit. And instead I just got caught up, swept up, talking about Michael Mann and about Ferrari, because I just really wanted to get this out, because just the reactions of film Twitter, it's crazy to have a movie that I think is, you know, kind of fantastic, but it's just in no way what I, if you would have shown me this, you know, in 1999 and said this is what a Michael Mann movie will be someday, I would have been like, what's going on? Where's the Dante Spinotti? This is, to go back to what I was starting out with, like the film, you know, the precocious film Twitter people saying, like, the, you know, doing their Michael Mann imitation about how this is like, you know, a classic Michael Mann guy, like Neil McCauley or Vincent in Collateral, and like these external forces on them as they navigate them in this efficient way, and this, you know, this idea of control and masculinity and all these concepts, of course, are in and out of every Michael Mann movie, and they're all here. And I guess what this movie does is it takes all that away, and it tells you this naturalistic story with a, you know, a domestic element, and kind of what I said about Oliver Stone, like gives that kind of character a certain grace at the end, even if I thought some of it was a little awkward. Like, there's a horrific tragedy that happens late in the movie that's a matter of history. I'm not spoiling it. It's something that's in every trailer. With that, you know, tragic accident. And then for a while, for like 10 minutes, it becomes, how's Ferrari gonna, you know, navigate out of this? And it's sort of, that there's like kind of just like shrug. We've spent enough time on this. He's good to go. And we give him a nice little, you know, again, I said I wasn't going to, these aren't spoiling the movie, but like he gets a little bit of a grace at the end where he kind of turns into two bits with a kindly old Italian man for a few minutes. And, you know, I guess in a way you could say like Michael Mann has earned it because he's had, you know, 40 years of crime movies with sort of these unrelenting, you know, an ending, you know, ending in carnage or ending in a shootout. And, you know, what's his name, you know, on the De Niro on the tarmac in Heat, and that, you know, Vincent, that's so poetic on the subway at the end of Collateral. I think that's kind of like one of his most beautiful endings. Like it's just the way it's shot, the dialogue to it, the way we've come around to liking, and the way that Jamie Foxx has come around, like this respect between them, the professional, and that moment where he just slips, man, just that one time he slips and he knows it. And when he goes for the gun, it's just perfect. And you think of those, and God, Thief, the ending of Thief with that shootout, with that comfortably numb ripoff wailing as James Caan, and that he's got those hunched shoulders that he has with that black leather jacket that's kind of short. And when he's loading the gun and swinging around and shooting at Dennis Farina, and at least in the old version, it had this awesome choppy editing. They, at some point, they made that like motion smooth in some of the, I hope they fixed that over time, because I used to have this weird VHS of it where they would speed up some of that footage. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's not a big deal, but I love that, you know, when Prosky has pushed him to his boiling point in that movie, and he just sets it all on fire, man. And when he starts like torching his lot and, you know, goes to Prosky's house, and that finale is just pure. I mean, that's a movie, I hate to say this because everyone says, oh, all these great scenes early on, you know, with obviously with Willie Nelson and these heists and the beach scene with Belushi with that synth and everything, all of it perfect, all of it. But it's one of those movies where I will just go watch that scene, just watch that shootout out of context. That's all I'm waiting for. The whole movie, even when I watch it, I just can't wait to get that. It's like one of the best. I mean, it's kind of, I don't, maybe somewhat in the realm of Taxi Driver, where there's a way, you know, more obvious queasiness about it, and it's shot very, it's very grim and very, you know, it's a catharsis in some ways, but it feels very, you know, impure. It feels very like unwholesome when Travis goes to that brothel or whatever it is and just starts shooting people's fingers off. But the one at the end of Thief is so earned. Like, just this dude that we've watched try to make it, you know, make it work. And when he gets fucked over the one last time by Prosky, and he just, that scene where Prosky's threatening him and about his family and everything, it's like satanic. And it's just like, you can't wait for him to have to just go to his, you know, his true self, I guess, maybe, as it were, at the end, just like, you know, coming in like this angel of vengeance. And when, and I'm, you know, going on about that or Heat or something, and Ferrari is so well done, and it's this story where it takes those kind of emotions and kind of almost puts it into a domestic drama in a way, with this relationship with Cruz's control over him, and her being the smarter of the two in so many ways, and kind of control. And when I tell you that, like, I'm doing like a hideous job of conveying what I really liked about it. And even the racing stuff, which is pretty exciting, but like, if you really wanted to see that kind of race, or, you know, the literal race stuff, you could watch the Ford versus Ferrari, and you'd probably get more of like a generic experience. That's probably what you would want. But I just, you know, I'm talking about in conjunction with like the things I'm saying about the evolution of man from Thief, from Keep, you know, on through, you know, the Ali era, Public Enemies, and then to kind of come to this, and kind of where this ends with giving that character, which is basically all those guys from all the other movies, and letting them off a little easy at the end. Like the old man that I was talking about himself over in Italy with his baggy shirt, he's all chill, he's relaxed, he's not hanging out, you know, studying crime and safe cracking and stuff. He's just taking it easy, and this movie is kind of relaxing for Michael Mann. Like, it's an old man. You got to be 100 years old to love it. Like, you have to be an old soul, I would say, or you have to be one of these weird, like, you know, 19-year-old letterbox kids who affects the persona of a 60-year-old cinephile. And it's just like, I can't pretend it's electric or that it gives you the satisfactions of a classic Michael Mann movie. It's taken it in a whole other direction. It's like an inverse Michael Mann movie in some ways. And if that doesn't sound like your thing, I totally get it. Like, it's such a hard movie to sell someone else on. It's clearly why it bombed, because it obviously didn't look like it had, you know, the mainstream appeal of the one, you know, the one with Bale and Damon. Which obviously kind of made it feel like, didn't we just do this 5 years ago? But if you're adventurous, if you, you know, if you really, it seems weird to describe a movie solely in terms of it doing things that are opposite of your expectations from that director. So it's like, it's almost like a cerebral exercise. And by that, I'm making it sound probably, you know, more miserable than it is, because I know a few people in my feed who saw this a couple times and just thought it was beautifully shot and it was exciting and they liked watching Adam Driver in his, you know, ridiculous accent navigate these issues and the Penelope Cruz stuff. So, you know, maybe it's not as, you know, off the wall as I'm describing it, or as, you know, stultifying as maybe I'm trying to prepare you for. It's just that all those things to me are really interesting, but it's interesting from a remove. It's interesting from, you know, balancing my expectations for man versus what the movie is and the push-pull of that. And that is entirely an internal exercise. That's not a movie giving you an electric experience beginning to end where you're captivated. I mean, you are captivated in the atmosphere of it. He sets up this time, this place, he builds to this race, there's this tragedy at the end. It has things that, you know, I'm not saying this is something completely inaccessible, but as like a Michael Mann movie goes, it's fairly close to an art film. And so however you feel about that, that's why I was a little bit surprised by the effusive tone. But then when I realize, you know, where these people have come to, you know, come at Michael Mann in his own timeline, this maybe does seem like an escalation from Miami Vice to Public Enemies to Black Hat to this sort of stripping away of all the classic pleasures of a Michael Mann movie. And in that regard, I find it really interesting. And, I, you know, pretty big thumbs up. But it's like, for the rest of my days, I'm just going to make fun of it being Penelope Cruz at the bank. But, you know, I just went off on that whole thing. I started this saying this was going to be about the Oscar movies, and I got so into talking about Ferrari. I'm sorry if I got a little long-winded there at the end, but I've been wanting to talk about it since I saw it, because it's a movie that interested me and frustrated me in equal measure, that I think is pretty good. And at this point, you know what, how about I cut this off and like I'll go do the real Oscar chat. Like, it's kind of, it would be misshapen to start that now. It's like, I just did an hour on Ferrari. Now you don't want to hear about like Emma Stone fapping with an apple, the Red Delicious in Poor Things, and hear me bitch about that and about Maestro and how Bradley Cooper is just Steve Martin in it. And it's, there's movies that like we're so sick of hearing about because it's the end of the year. And I just like, where else am I going to get to talk about Ferrari? And then I get so excited talking about Michael Mann. And I guess maybe as I did that, you can kind of tell, like, you know, just like what I light up about Michael Mann, and how kind of none of that is in Ferrari, but yet Ferrari's still really good. But again, apologies. I'll do a part two, and I know I always say this and then don't, but I really did want to goof on some of the Oscar movies, one of which I still haven't seen yet, but it's just like, it would be so out of step with what this has just been about for an hour. How about we cut it here, man? I had a good time talking about that. Maybe that'll keep you preoccupied thinking about Ferrari, or maybe you'll go check it out and tell me I'm insane, or, you know, maybe you'll agree with the guys who say, oh, this is the best he's ever done. Yeah, yeah. It's a regular Manhunter, dude. If you loved Will Graham peeling off those labels on the Leeds tapes, you're sure going to love Penelope Cruz doing a withdrawal at the B of A, or the B of I, whatever it would be. Anyway, that's Ferrari. That's my time for today. I hope if you like Michael Mann, that was sort of sufficient as a mini lightning round and a little take on Ferrari. I might have gotten a little highfalutin with that. I apologize if I did, and I hope you enjoyed it. I always love doing these, and I'd love to do more of them if I can, and I will come back and talk to you about the incredibly important matter of the Oscar movies, which, God, can you imagine? I think, like, the biggest thing is like Oppenheimer is like the 900-pound elephant or 2-ton elephant in the middle of this, and it's so good, and it's probably, you know, from some remove, if there's such a thing as objective, which I don't, you know, it seems like the kind of thing that will win, that maybe should win, that everything seems in place for it. It's just a movie that like has been talked to death for 6 months. So has Barbie. Like, I have nothing to say about them. So when I do my Oscar pod, you know, the official one that this started out being, I'm just going to make fun of, you know, I'm just going to have to fill it with like, you know, making fun of Bradley Cooper singing in that little sailor suit in Maestro, where I've never been more wrong about the Oscars, by the way. When he was doing that ridiculous dance number early on in Maestro, he's got the sailor suit on. I was like, I saw it in a theater. I didn't see it on Netflix, and it was all old timers. Everyone in there was like 115 years old, blue hairs, tapping along, and they came out of that movie, they're like, that was terrific, going up to the popcorn kid, have you seen Maestro? And I thought, this is it, man, that's got everything. If you're some old ass in the Academy, and you got Leonard Bernstein, and old-timey musicals, and West Side Story, and a guy, not closeted, but a gay guy with his beard, and, you know, the magical woman who supports him while he's out doing his thing, you know, that kind of thing resonates in Hollywood, you know. I thought this had everything across the board, and it seems like a total also-ran. And maybe that's where I'll start on the real podcast when I get to you next time. All right, I hope you had fun with this one. Hey, have a nice day. All right, bye.